Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back, everybody. We're back with Viet History Makers with my co-host, Kevin Pham. Welcome back, Kevin.
Hello, Ken, and hello, everybody. Excited to be back here.
You know, today is an interesting figure that we've been talking about, discussing this figure. And there's a lot of parallels to what's happening in the world today, in the modern world today. When we think of this president, the last president of the South Vietnamese government, we think about somebody who basically really fought to the very end of the road. And I think his journey is complicated.
Well, I do want to quickly mention that technically he was not the last president, right? He's the last serious president, but there were two presidents right after him for just a few days, and we'll talk about that. But Nguyen Van Thieu, when I said this name to my dad, I received such a strong reaction from my father, and not a good one. He almost exploded in contempt and revulsion. And my dad said, he's corrupt and pathetic. He led an incompetent government. Why even discuss him? Don't do him. He told me not to discuss Nguyen Van Thieu. Yeah. Well, what I want to say is that, well, today we are not only going to discuss Nguyen Van Thieu, but we're also going to discuss some key events leading to the end of the war, to the downfall of South Vietnam. Because as you had mentioned, he was South Vietnam's last serious president. One thing I want to say, though, real quick, is that right now, it's currently March 2025, almost the 50th anniversary of the end of the war, and it's cause for some reflection. And so I'm going to imagine the listener as a young, this is who I have in mind, a young Vietnamese American who wants to learn about like what happened, right? How did South Vietnam fall? So that's why I'm interested in discussing him.
Yeah, and I think that when I'm sitting here trying to formulate questions for you, I'm trying to figure out, is he representative of, you know, just a losing faction that's, you know, nearing its end? Or is he himself the cause of the loss? Or I wouldn't put the blame squarely on him, but is his team, is his government, is his administration, could they have done something different, maybe, to resuscitate? Or was the cards dealt way before he ended his administration?
These are excellent questions, and it's anyone's guess. You know, we can only suppose and guess. But like, he kind of reminds me of our episode on Bao Dai. You know,
yeah,
this sad figure. He may have had aspirations, but failed.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So, you know, before you get started, I just want to remind the audience that, you know, I know that Winventu is not your, you know, you don't naturally come to this table knowing everything about Winventu. You have to spend a lot of time at a coffee shop and you have to really dig deep and research this person because he's not in your, I'm asking you to stretch every time we reach outside of a certain age, or not age, but a certain period of Vietnamese history. So I want to remind everybody that, especially on YouTube, there's a super thanks button that you could donate to our sub-series here at the Vietnamese Podcast. Kevin, you want to add to that?
Thanks, Ken. I mean, it's always so awkward to ask for donations, but it does give me a boost of morale and encouragement. So I very much appreciate it. So thank you, everyone.
And we definitely want to keep going. We don't want to stop this sub-series. I just want to add also that, you know, my usual programming of living Vietnamese people has been, you know, I had to put that on hold for, you know, a good month and a half because I produced the movie. I was asked to produce a movie. And so I couldn't really work on the podcast. And, you know, this sub-series, I couldn't stop. I mean, I should have stopped it, but I didn't want to lose our momentum because I know you worked so hard to come to the to come to this sub-series fully stacked every week. So I appreciate you.
Thanks. So let's jump into it. So today we're discussing the last serious president of South Vietnam. And I say serious president because he was not technically the last president of South Vietnam. So he was president for 7 years and a half. And then he fled the country on April 21, 1975. And as we all know, the war ended on April 30, right? So after April 21, Truong Van Hung, who was Nguyen Van Thieu's vice president, would be president for just a few days, April 21 to April 28, so 7 days. And then the last president is Dzung Van Minh, who is president for 2 days. So in this episode, we're going to briefly go over Nguyen Van Thieu's life, but really, in my view, I would like to use him to talk about South Vietnam more generally and the last, you know, the years, its downfall. And I also want to talk about some of the assumptions that I think he had about the war. So before I begin, I mean, Ken, what comes to your mind when you hear the name Nguyen Van Thieu?
Oh my God, this is so, such a touchy subject. And I just want to preface this answer by saying my entire family was on the South. Many of them were in, you know, the camps right after the war, 6 years to 13 years. So there's a, when I think of him, I think of my father's feelings towards the South Vietnamese government, which is, it wasn't a monolith. I think there were so many different factions in the South Vietnamese government. And I think that just like in America today, there is a spectrum of support for whoever's president. And when I think of Nguyen Van Thieu, I've come from a very mixed emotion. And I think that it's natural to feel some sort of allegiance to your mom and dad's government. But at the same time, I think we're given the keys. We're allowed to really break down in truth, our truth, in our research and in our discovery of who these figures were, and we can talk openly about it. We're not afraid of persecution or retribution from our community, because I think, you know, I'm going to lean in on your research and your time spent learning about his life and really analyzing it for what it's worth.
Yeah, for sure.
That was an answer without answering, though.
Yeah, no, that's good, though. I mean, before we jump into the biography, I do want to make some remarks that I think it's interesting how after the war, I mean, he lived in London and then in Boston, and he lived a very quiet life. He deliberately, on the accounts I've read, he deliberately stayed out of Vietnamese refugee anti-communist politics, perhaps because he felt he would be blamed for his government's failures.
What a lonely, that sounds like such a lonely existence.
Yeah. And you know, when I hear my dad's reaction to him, that's completely consistent, because my dad got angry. And so he doesn't want to face that kind of anger from people like my dad.
Yeah. Yep.
But one quote that I found interesting. So he said, Nguyen Van Thieu said, I talk with them. So Vietnamese who criticize him, this is after the war. He says, I talk with them very frankly, sincerely. You say that you blame me for the fall of South Vietnam. You criticize me, everything. I let you do that. I like to see you do better than I. That's interesting, right? Like what would you do as president of a side that is losing, right? What would you do?
I mean, that's the question of this podcast. What would you do if you were losing?
Right.
What do you do when you lose, when you're losing? Yeah. I mean, clearly. But they, you know what they say, their heroes are made, you know, during moments of crisis. So there's even a Vietnamese saying that says that the times creates the, I forget what the word is, I forget what that, somebody's going to comment in the YouTube section. But yeah, it's really, if he was a stronger leader, perhaps he could have turned the ship around. Who knows?
Who knows? Some more general remarks about how he might generally be seen. He was known to be a very cautious man. Again, by the way, I'm just quoting some obituaries that I've read online. In a New York Times obituary, it said that what counted most for Thieu was personal loyalty. So generals in the South Vietnam Army tended to be promoted based on their allegiance to Thieu more than merit. And unlike President Ngo Dinh Diem, by the way, Nguyen Van Thieu helped to overthrow Diem in 1963. Nguyen Van Thieu was neither loved nor deeply hated, though he did not hesitate to use his secret police to throw his enemies in jail. He somehow used his power less oppressively than Mr. Diem had and generated less passionate emotions. Maybe some people will agree with that. Maybe some will not. But so let's get into the bio, yeah?
Yep.
Cool. So he was born not too far from Da Lat in Phan Rang, and he was the youngest of five children. And his father was a prosperous fisherman, a farmer who owned some land. When World War II ended, Nguyen Van Thieu joined, or it's believed that he joined the Viet Minh. But he soon became disillusioned. And I'm going to quote him. He said, I knew that the Viet Minh were communists. They shot people. They overthrew the village committees. They seized the land. And eventually he became convinced that the Viet Minh were dangerous. And so he goes to Saigon with the help of his older brother, and he joins the Merchant Marine Academy. So he goes to this Vietnamese National Military Academy in Da Lat, which the French had created to train officers to fight the Viet Minh. And there he becomes a good officer, a good student. He learns good French. And keep in mind that he is Buddhist. But in 1951, he marries a Catholic woman and he converts to Catholicism. So then he becomes a colonel in the South Vietnamese Army. And in 1960, apparently he tried to stop a coup attempt against Diem in 1960. But then in 1963, he was organized the coup that ousts Ngo Dinh Diem. And then, so that's the end of what we call the First Republic of South Vietnam, when Ngo Dinh Diem dies. And in the few years after that, between 1963 and 67, there's what we call a military junta, right? A government led by military leaders. It's kind of chaotic. It's led by military leaders. And he and Nguyen Cao Ky become leaders of the military junta in 1965. Now, Nguyen Cao Ky is another interesting figure. By the way, my dad is not a fan of him as well. My dad has strong feelings. My dad just says, oh, he's a cowboy. He's a flamboyant cowboy with his gun at his hip.
You know, so I actually want to interject here. I think he's also a very complex figure that we will eventually need to cover, because I think his flamboyancy and his lifestyle and ultimately his return to Vietnam is a big source of it's just a big source of pain for, I think, a lot of Vietnamese Americans. But I think that there's some things that are a redeeming that we don't understand, that I've talked to some older folks who were close to him at the time. There are some redeeming qualities of what he did in his last year. It's counterintuitive what we thought, him going back to Vietnam, shaking hands with the new government when he was, you know, the top general, and he fled and he told all his, you know, younger guys to stay back and fight. So it's very controversial, but we'll get into this when we do his life.
Interesting. Good. Yeah. So Nguyen Cac Cu, he was a chief of the Vietnamese Air Force, but his relationship with Nguyen Van Thieu would be, I mean, they were rivals. They would become rivals, right? So moving on here. So I had mentioned they become leaders of the military junta in 1965. And then in 1966, there's a Buddhist uprising. And these Buddhists are defying the central government authority. And this is important to say at this period, because what this leads to is that the military junta then makes political concessions to regain popular legitimacy and to attract more American support. So in 1967, what we see in South Vietnam is a new constitution. There's a bicameral assembly. There's presidential elections. And there's some more stability now. And so South Vietnamese civil society, you can say, flourishes after this. The arts, the sciences, the humanities. There's a flourishing period for a few years until 1971. We'll talk about what happens then. But what happens is that Nguyen Van Thieu, he wins the presidency in 1967 in the elections. He wins 34% of the popular vote. And this is the beginning of the Second Republic of Vietnam. Moving on here, the famous Tet Offensive happens in January of 1968. And this is significant because the communists attack not only Saigon, but other towns during what was supposed to be a ceasefire. And these Tet attacks generate some short-lived anti-communist solidarity. Remember that the South is quite fractured, but it generates some anti-communist solidarity. And also the communists' massacre of a few thousand civilians in Hue. This leads some Southerners who might have been more ambivalent to be more anti-communist. Now, however, this also is significant, the Tet Offensive, because for Americans, the Tet Offensive really turns them even more against the war. I mean, this is a really, really violent time. 1968 was an extremely violent year.
You know, I recently worked on a Netflix documentary as a translator from Vietnamese to English, and I had to translate a few of these interviews, and I learned something. I didn't know that the Tet Offensive was not one battle. There was like 8 or 9 that were happening in conjunction with each other during that time. So it wasn't just like one big battle. I always thought it was just one huge thing, but there was planned attacks in like 8 or 9 different, you know, like the embassy of the United States and, you know, different hotspots throughout Saigon. It was going off, and it was a bloody affair.
Right. Yeah. And and by the way, just I think I had read somewhere that during the Tet Offensive, he was somewhere in the Mekong Delta with his wife, whereas Nguyen Cao Ky had to take care of things in Saigon. And maybe I shouldn't even mention this if I don't know the details, but I think there was something there, like who was supposed to deal with the Tet Offensive and maybe some that he didn't properly or something. Ugh.
I've heard that before too. Okay. I actually heard that he was not around.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so he wins the presidency again in 1971, and this is a clearly rigged election.
Wow.
So, I mean, Thieu actually wrote instructions to rig the election, and these were leaked, and then the opposition candidates withdrew in protest. So the government, and by the way, this whole time, the Americans are putting their influence behind Win Ventil. You know, they see him as the man to fight against communism. So the government then silences opposition parties, and we see some very similar things as in Ngo Dinh-Diem, right? But by this point, I think it's really important to talk about the Americans, because we have to. At this point, the Americans really want to get out of Vietnam. Now, what I want to talk about now is the summer of 1972. And this is really significant for Nguyen Van Thieu. So Henry Kissinger, he's the Secretary of State of the United States. And at the time, Nixon is president. Henry Kissinger starts negotiations with the North Vietnamese, the communists. And the person he talks to is Lê Đức Thọ. And Kissinger's main goal is to have an independent and secure South Vietnam. And the Americans want to do this through what they call Vietnamization. So they want to strengthen South Vietnam while pulling out U.S. soldiers. So Kissinger meets secretly with Lê Đức Thọ in Paris. And in October of 72, they talk. And Kissinger's, his aim, again, as I mentioned, to make South Vietnam secure enough for the U.S. to pull out its troops. And Lê Đức Thọ's aim was to give the Viet Cong, well, I mean, we call them the Viet Cong, but they're called the National Liberation Front. And they have their group in the South was called the Provisional Revolutionary Government of the Republic of South Vietnam. So that's the Viet Cong in the South. His aim was to give them real power in the South. So not just like this terrorist force, right? You want real power. And Kissinger famously wants to secure what he calls, I wonder if he actually used this phrase or if other people used it later. But it's the famous decent interval theory. You've heard about this?
I have not.
Okay, so Kissinger essentially wants a decent interval between the moment the U.S. withdraws and the moment South Vietnam collapses, so that it doesn't look like the U.S. caused South Vietnam to collapse. I love this as a political scientist, by the way, because in political science, we talk about causation, like what causes what. And there's a very famous philosopher named David Hume, Scottish philosopher of the Enlightenment. And he essentially says, there's no way to know what causes what. All we see is something happen and then something else happened right after that. And so if the time space is short enough, then you could say, oh, that caused it, but you cannot see causation. So Kissinger wants enough time to pass so that people can't blame it on the U.S., essentially. So that's a decent interval theory. So Lê Đức Thọ concedes that South Vietnam can be part of a coalition with the communists, the Provisional Revolutionary Government, and together they can organize future elections in the South. And Kissinger concedes, and he also agrees. Kissinger agrees to let North Vietnamese troops stay in South Vietnam in exchange for releasing American prisoners of war. Okay, they're making an agreement. And Kissinger is excited, and he says to the world, peace is at hand. But guess what? When Nguyen Van Thieu learns about this negotiation, which was done totally behind his back, he is furious. He's angry, and he completely refuses to accept it. And I'll talk about this later, but in a later speech, Nguyen Van Thieu says, the United States sold us, the South Vietnamese, to the communists. He says, I'm quoting him, I had enough courage to tell Secretary of State Kissinger at the time, if you accept this agreement, this means you accept to sell South Vietnam to the North Vietnamese communists. As for me, if I accept this agreement, I will be a traitor. I refuse to accept this agreement.
You know, the weirdest thing right now is I'm listening to this, and it is the exact thing that's happening to President Zelensky and Ukraine right now. It's all of these, why does the world allow these superpowers to meddle in these small country affairs? It's just the most absurd, unfair thing. And we're in 2025, and you think that it stopped in Vietnam. Listening to this is absurd today. listening to what happened at William Thiel.
But Ken, they need the money of those powerful countries. No, they need the weapons, right? So this is going to be a huge theme for Nguyen Van Thiel. So Nguyen Van Thiel rejects the deal that Kissinger and Lê Duc Tha made. Thiel does not want to work with the communists. Let's keep fighting the communists, he says. Kissinger says, however, no. And he tells President Nixon, sign the deal without Thiel's approval. But what happens is Nixon actually sides with Thiel. Nixon says, okay, let's reopen the talks and let's talk again. Now, the North Vietnamese are upset and they think Kissinger lied to them. And the talks go nowhere. And Nixon demands that the North Vietnamese return to negotiations. I think he gave them like 72 hours. Return to negotiations or we bomb you. They don't return to negotiations. And then Nixon decides to unleash the most dramatic bombing. I mean, this is called the Christmas bombing campaign, dropping 36,000 tons of bombs throughout North Vietnam in December of 1972. And it's the most intense aerial bombardment in world history. And it's condemned in Congress and around the world. Well, what eventually happens is that talks do reopen in 1973. So these are called the Paris Peace Talks. And the deal is essentially the same. And Nixon finally agrees. And President Thieu at first, again, refuses to sign the accords. But Nixon promises him, look, Thieu, we, the United States, will come to the aid of South Vietnam if the communists violate the terms of the peace treaty. And then eventually Nguyen Van Thieu agrees to sign. And just as a side note, by the way, among the North Vietnamese representatives at the Paris Peace Talks in 73 is Nguyen Thi Binh. And some listeners have mentioned that we should discuss her. And she is also the granddaughter of Phan Chu Trinh, by the way. Interesting.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, right? It's all connected.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay. So the Paris Peace Talks are signed and peace is at hand, and they offer Kissinger and Lê Duc Tha the Nobel Peace Prize, and Lê Duc Tha denies he doesn't want the Peace Prize. But at this point, there's still South Vietnam, there's still President Thieu, and there's still a lot of American economic military aid. So with the 1973 peace accords signed in Paris, what happens is Americans withdraw completely. Well, except for a few Marines guarding the embassy in Saigon, but still everything feels inconclusive. There's still fighting between the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese. And the South Vietnamese officials don't want to uphold the treaty that they signed. They don't want to cooperate with the communist government, in the provisional revolutionary government in South Vietnam. So Nguyen Van Thieu has four no's. No negotiation with communists, no surrender of territory, no coalition government, no communist political activity. And so, I mean, Saigon violates the ceasefire by attacking areas controlled by the communists. And then, and by the way, in October of 73, there's a meeting among North Vietnamese, and to them, they think that the prospect for revolution is better than ever since 1954. So they're going to call for more continuous violence to overthrow the Saigon regime. And they do. They attack and they win in many places against the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. Okay, back in the United States, Congress and the American public really, really want an end to U.S. involvement once and for all. I mean, they're already withdrawing, but they also don't want to keep pumping money into South Vietnam. And South Vietnam's biggest weakness at this time is that the public doesn't support the institutions that it's creating. There's poor morale. And U.S. withdrawal also hurts the economy in the South. There's unemployment. And back in the U.S., Congress passes the War Powers Act so that the president would have to inform Congress 48 hours before any American troops are deployed. And so they also cut aid to South Vietnam in half. This is really important for our discussion from Nguyen Van Thieu. Now, remember I had said that Nixon had promised Nguyen Van Thieu, look, sign the peace treaty at the communist attack, I will help you. Well, Nixon resigns in August of 1974 because of the Watergate scandal, right? And now the new president is Gerald Ford.
I'm following.
So the communists then start attacking South Vietnam even more. And then they decide in mid-1974 to launch a major attack to seize control over parts of South Vietnam. And this catches the South Vietnamese army by surprise. So this is an attack at Buôn Ma Thuột. And Nguyễn Văn Thiệu, this is an interesting thing here. He reacts by suppressing the news of what's happening. And so he and his generals decide to withdraw from the Central Highlands and to abandon that region to communist control. And he never announces this decision. But then soon people start to know about it. And then people of Vietnamese start fleeing these areas. And so here at this point, we're seeing demands for Nguyễn Văn Thiệu's resignation. So some other South Vietnamese hope that another candidate can negotiate a ceasefire with Hanoi, save whatever's left of South Vietnam. But he didn't want to. Now, this is really, really interesting here. So finally, on April 21, Nguyễn Văn Thiệu announces that he's quitting. He does not accept responsibility for what's happening. He's going to blame the media and the foreign media for creating panic among the population. And so by early 1975, it looks like the communists are going to have total victory soon. They're moving north to south. City after city is being captured by the communists. The goal is to capture Saigon. President Ford, meanwhile, asks Congress for $722 million for military aid. And it's interesting, like, why did he ask this? Maybe he knew that Congress would deny the request so he could blame Congress for the fall of Saigon. Congress says no, but they would give $300 million in humanitarian aid to evacuate Americans from South Vietnam. And so anyway, Nguyễn Văn Thiệu resigns. And this is, okay, I'm done now with the bio part. But for the rest of this episode, what I do want to talk about is his resignation speech, because I read the whole thing and it's kind of long, actually. Like, I could not imagine sitting there listening to this, but I found some interesting things from this speech. So anyway, I'll pause there.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What are your thoughts?
You know, I think once we found ourselves in the Watergate, in the midst of Watergate and Nixon having to resign, I think the momentum of the war on the South Vietnamese side, just the air went out of the tires. It's just completely deflated at that point. And I think that there's no way that you could recover from your big brother just getting, you know, there's chaos in the big brother's house. And, you know, your enemy is going to be like, this is the perfect time to take over. And this is the perfect time to come in and do our business and take over. And I think that there was nothing Nguyễn Văn Thiệu could do. I mean, it's almost impossible without, you know, having money.
And it's not just money, but like, I hear this, you know, and by the way, I mean, just as a side note, My expertise is in the French colonial period. And when I start getting towards the Vietnam War stuff, I don't want to be seen as more of the professor today. I want to have this dialogue with you because, like, I hear things from my elders, you know, and they know more than me about these war years. And I hear about the corruption in the South. And I personally have heard of, I mean, I personally know some teachers, some high school teachers in the South where they were making a lot of money by passing children, boys, and giving them good grades so that they wouldn't have to go into the South Vietnamese army. Mm. And they would brag about the amount of money that they got from these kids' parents. So the kind of corruption that you were seeing, you know, so it, yeah.
But, you know, let's talk a little bit about this corruption. You know, I think when we think about Southeast Asian countries or Asia in general, maybe not Japan and Korea, but the amount of corruption is a standard. It's not an exception. It's a standard. I think it's in the cultural way we do business in Vietnam. And we are learning throughout the last, you know, few decades that this does not work. Bribery, corruption is a really bad thing. But I think pre-75, these things were normal in the Philippines and Thailand and, you know, China. And
this makes sense to me when I think of Ho Chi Minh and his repeated insistence that you must be righteous and not corrupt. I mean, he's constantly talking about these Confucian moral values. And now that I hear you saying that, it kind of makes sense. Like, he feels the need to say these things.
Yeah. So when we're talking about all these figures, I mean, you have to bring in these sort of like the contemporary vibes at the time about corruption. And, you know, just like the whole Martin Luther Reformation of the Catholic Church at the time in 1517, you have to kind of acknowledge at the time that the Catholic Church was super corrupt and he had to do this. And then now we have the Protestants and we have the Lutherans and we have these different sects because, you know, they branch off and do their own thing. And I think when you think about Ho Chi Minh and living in a righteous Confucius way, you cannot accept what your cultural norms are at the time. And we have to really understand these things because then we can look at things in a more balanced way. And we just can't write off Ho Chi Minh. We can't write off Nguyen Văn Thiệu. We just understand, like, this is the way the world was being lived at the time.
Yeah. So let's go to the resignation speech. I mean, this is the end of Nguyen Văn Thiệu's political career here. So he's at Independence Palace. It's April 21, 1975. And anybody can read the transcript online, but he starts by apologizing to everybody for not preparing a message for them. So he says, "I'm sorry I invited you here on such short notice, but the situation is urgent. If I had more time, I would have convened a plenary session of different parts of the government to make it more democratic. But at this point, I'm just going to tell you what's happening." And he says they were in a good situation, South Vietnam, up to 1968. But that from 1968 to 1972, peace talks made no progress. The communists, and I'm quoting him, he says, "The communists became more and more stubborn, fighting while talking, talking while fighting. They skillfully applied this tactic. They succeeded in deceiving the world and the United States." I'm still quoting here. "The communist strategy is that when they are strong militarily, they fight vigorously while holding talks perfunctorily. And when they are weak militarily, they fight that way but come on strong in the talks." So in 1972, end quote. In 1972, the communists gets a lot stronger because they received thousands of tanks and weapons from the Soviet Union and China. And he says, we had talked about Kissinger with the secret negotiations. And so Nguyen Văn Thiệu then says the United States sold South Vietnam to the communists. And this part is interesting here. So he says, I'm quoting him, "I call the communist country the DRV, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and they must call our country, this country, the Republic of Vietnam. Neither country must invade the other. the 17th parallel and the Geneva Agreement must serve as a basis pending the day of national reunification through peaceful and democratic means. This is kind of like really interesting because essentially he's recognizing communist North Vietnam and he's asking that they recognize. So he's like, look, let's accept that there are two separate countries. Let's not try to invade each other. And this, he might sound reasonable here if you consider that in 1954, 800,000 people went from the north to the south and 80% of them were Catholics. And a lot of them wanted to march back up north and liberate it from communism. So he, like Ngo Dinh Diem, are not going to talk about marching up north and invading the north. And this is going to piss off a lot of people in South Vietnam who do want to invade the north and take it back from the communists.
God, you just can't win.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no way.
By the way, quick advertisement for Nam Phong Dialogues with Yin Vu. She and I, we in our most recent episode, which was released yesterday, we talk about this 1954 migration with the Catholics in the South. Anyway, so he wants to recognize the communists in this speech, but he says they want to dominate all of Vietnam. Now, what's interesting to me is that he says he told Nixon that the U.S. should give us a lot of aid for 3 or 5 years so that we could develop our economy and then gradually reduce the aid to zero by 1980. So that was his hope. But then, of course, Watergate happens. This prevents U.S. aid getting to Vietnam. The communists know this. They take advantage of it all. But the point I want to make here is that throughout his speech, he's just so dependent on U.S. aid, and he keeps talking about this patient metaphor. He keeps using this metaphor. So he says, imagine there's a sick person, a weak patient. The weak patient will get weaker. A strong patient remains strong. So he says, I'm going to quote him, our war material has gradually decreased. That is why we have lost. On the contrary, the communists at the outset had an amount of war material which has steadily increased. Thus, no matter how brave our combatants may be, no matter how skillful our commanders may be, we must suffer losses and lose land and people. We have realized this fact and cannot endure it. What do you make of that?
I think that he's just really telling the truth of his position. And I think that, you know, it creates a little conflict in me. And here's what I mean. Every time I think about this sort of money and aid that's coming from the United States versus money and aid coming from Russia or China at the time for the communists, I think if all things are equal, all things in terms of like money going into each side is equal, I can't help but think that the American side, the Vietnamese South side, is actually getting better weapons, better technology, better support than whatever communism is receiving from China and Russia. But what makes them beat the hell out of the South? It really rocks me to my core when I think about all things being equal, money's going into both sides, tanks, materials, war materials, each going in. The American side had to have better technology. We had to have better warfare strategy and tactics. And if you think about like the 60s and 70s, Russia was probably struggling, whatever they're sending in. Their technology cannot beat the American technology. And how did they gather?
Okay. At this point, I do want to say that I've been listening like a huge nerd to debates between, oh my God, why is my brain like suddenly debates with John F. Kennedy and Nixon. I've been listening to debates between John F. Kennedy and Nixon in the 60s. I mean, John F. Kennedy, this whole time, he's essentially saying, you guys, us fellow Americans, we are losing to the Russians. They are producing twice as many scientists, twice as many doctors as us. I mean, the Soviet Union, their economy was steadily growing until 1989. I mean, they were, for last previous episodes, you had asked me, give me an example of a successful communist country, whatever. I mean, if you think of in terms of giving everybody jobs, food, housing, healthcare, pensions, paid vacations, so on, the Soviet Union was providing this. It was. And one argument is that the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed is because, well, the United States kept intensely pressuring the Soviet Union. And so the Soviet Union pumped all this money into the military, which took away from serving its own people. And so Gorbachev had to make a decision. Do I escalate this Cold War or do I capitulate to the capitalist countries? And then people on the communist side are going to say that's why the Soviet Union collapsed, because they implemented capitalist reforms, which ruined their economy. Anyway, this is not part of the episode, but we're talking about the Soviet Union. We're talking about the United States. And you are raising an important point, which is the question, given equality of material aid, right? What is the difference? One on who's sympathetic to the communists might give a very simple answer, which is that, well, those people, those communists, the peasants, the oppressed, they're a lot more angry.
Yep.
And they have the spirit of fighting.
That's how I feel. And I'm like, when I analyze, you know, where we come from and where our parents, sometimes they're blinded by that and they can't admit that. I'm not trying to piss anybody off here, but because they were angrier and because they were driven by the same sort of doctrine, which is we want this country to be ran by Vietnamese people and not have strings attached to the United States or to another outside France or a bigger superpower, that when you're driven by this autonomy and you're like, I want freedom for my people, you're willing to lay your life down. And I think when money and aid is coming in, so it's flowing to the South, it's like almost like children having all this material power. And I don't think that it was probably used well, perhaps, that the funding was probably, you know, trickled down to their families and then, you know, people socked money away and it wasn't used entirely for the war effort.
Right, right. And Nguyen Van Thieu, he keeps using these metaphors. So I told you about the patient metaphor, but he also says, this is like if you give me $3 and urge me to travel first class or to buy 5 steaks and 8 glasses of wine. It's impossible. It's absurd. So, and he even does this thought experiment that you and I just did. He says, if each side were given no foreign aid, they would be equal. North Vietnam can do nothing better than South Vietnam because it can produce no bullets, no weapons, rockets, or tanks. So this small South Vietnam is fighting against the Soviet Union and Red China while its ally fails to protect and aid it. So he is fierce, angry at the United States. I mean, he says to the United States, you have let our combatants die under a hail of shells. This is an inhuman act by an inhuman ally. And so this becomes really interesting here because he presents his resignation as a selfless act that might help get aid to South Vietnam. Because his theory is that if I leave, then the U.S. is going to give us aid because the U.S. isn't giving us aid because they don't like me. So he says that the U.S. says that so long as Thieu is in power, there can be no aid from the United States. So he says, if with my departure, abundant U.S. aid will be provided, this will be lucky for us, and my departure is like a grain of sand in the desert. So it's insignificant. It's an insignificant act on my part, but a very well worthwhile sacrifice.
Let's go back to this thought experiment you just said. If no sides were getting aid, the North would have probably beat the hell out of the South at that time. Because they're coagulating around this principle of kicking foreigners out. And I think the drive and the determination of the North, you know, I mean, this is such a tricky thing to talk about, but I think, and I'm going to, this is a conjecture, complete, like I'm going to go off the rails. When you have a class of uneducated, in the North, peasants that just go to war and are being told, and they do what they're told. They're not very educated. They just have one mission, is to take over the South. I think in the South, there were many people daydreaming about living abroad. There were many people daydreaming about being very westernized, being very modern, living in a way that's above their means, perhaps. I don't know. But when I think about like the luxury of the Saigon era, and think about how people had a great time and culture flourished, I don't know if they were really in the mindset of beating back these northern counterparts. You know, they were just enjoying a great life in the South. And I think that it's hard to coalesce and get, you know, together and fight back this, you know, this invading, you know, group of people that are coming down for you. And they're like, they have nothing. So they're going to give their lives to get something. And I think it's very different in the South.
Yeah. I mean, Ken, if what you just said is not entirely true, it must have some truth to it. Like it must. I mean, that makes sense to me. So let me just give one more quote from Winventio here. He says, "The reason I resigned today is the fact that today the U.S. Congress is going to scrutinize the problem of aid. I think that after my resignation today, maybe tomorrow, the $300 million will be raised to $722 million or to more than a billion, and then a continuous airlift will bring in tanks and heavy artillery. Since I am gone, here comes the aid, and more aid. I hope so." So one thing that I want to say here is that it strikes me that he has a purely materialist understanding here, that like, if you just give us more weapons, we're going to win. This is exactly what we're talking about. He really downplays ideology, which I think is a mistake. People need a reason for fighting. Yeah.
Where's your why? And that's the thing about the South. We were missing that why. The real reason the North comes in, and the real reason of living, is their why was so strong. We want to have complete autonomy of our country. And in the South, it was like, wait, we're sucking on the golden teat of the U.S. and life is so good with this aid. And I think it corrupted the South. It corrupted. It spoiled the South. I'm sure this is not a popular thing amongst our.
I mean, everything you're saying right now is completely consistent with criticisms of liberal ideology. So in liberal ideology, you respect individuals for them to pursue their own goals. You see people as individuals. So liberals are criticized for not offering a broader social purpose. This is very different from communism, where there is a collective social purpose. There's a social revolution. Now, we have talked about ideology. You know, what was the ideology of the South? Now, Ngo Dinh-Diem said it was personalism. We talked about this on our episode on Ngo Dinh-Diem. But personalism is extremely vague. It is anti-communist, but it's also anti-capitalist. And so I've been reading speeches from Ngo Dinh-Diem, and it's so interesting where he says, the question of should we have capitalism or socialism in South Vietnam is not important. We're just going to do whatever makes the people happy. He literally says that. You know, he's just so vague. He's so vague.
If you listen to the general speeches of like the South, and I haven't heard a whole lot of them, but you never really get the sense of like, let's go and fight because there is some real reason to. Instead, you hear this complaining, this bitching that Winventio does on his last day.
I mean, I'm going to try to be more fair here to the South. So there's a lot of new research on the South among scholars of Vietnam. I had mentioned them, like building a Republican nation, building a Republic of Vietnam and anti-communist nationalism, like these books edited by Tung Vu and Nguyen Chan. And they are going to argue that the people in the South had the ideology that's called republicanism. Now, reader, this has nothing to do with the Republican Party of the United States. Republicanism is a political ideology that champions representative government, the universal rights of man, civil liberties, and it's very nationalist. So it's the primacy of the nation. And this is different, arguably, from communism of the North in that it's internationalist. It's ultimately about world communist revolution. It's not nationalist.
But I think all of that probably would have played out in a different way, maybe in a good way. Yeah. But I think once you start introducing foreign money and foreign control and foreign power into the system in the South, that's when things are going to go haywire, because it's like a teenager. All of a sudden, a teenager gets all this money. He's going to go out and buy a sports car. He's going to do things that when you don't earn it, inch by inch by inch, by fighting like the communists. And I'm not taking sides. I'm just analyzing, you know, I'm just thinking about human nature. When you are given a bag of money, I don't think that the earned money is different from non-earned money. When they give it to you, you have to answer to the big boss who's giving you the money. Yeah. And I think it's a two-way thing. It's a problem where you can't make your own decisions and you're crippled by the money that's given to you for aid.
This reminds me, again, the political theorist in me. There's an argument for why the Athenians in ancient Greece were so good at winning their wars against the Persian Empire, because the Persian Empire is seen as this despotic government. There's no democracy in the Persian Empire, but in Athens, there's democracy where people fight for themselves, for their family. They're not fighting for a king as the Persians are fighting for their king. And that's what makes the Athenians fight so much more stronger.
Yeah, I strongly believe that. And I think that's kind of the problem with America where we are today. We've been prosperous for so long, and I think we're at the end, late stage of capitalism almost, you know? And I think it's a worrisome time for a country like the United States if we don't reprogram and get our asses handed to us somehow, and we just become just more dedicated to our why. I think we've lost our way in the United States somehow. Mm. I mean, that includes me. I'm just, you know, in Vietnamese we say, Sung Hoa Wa Ding. That means you've had such a great life that you kind of like lose it. You lose your marbles. And I think we're there. That's, I don't know. The greatest generation in the 40s were like 50s where they had to fight back, you know, in the United States, you know, and that led to the greatest generation after World War II.
Yeah. I mean, listeners also might be interested in Pierre Asselin's books on the American war in Vietnam, but also he pays attention to the North. I mean, the North had all this experience fighting the French. They had experience, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's, well, what's going to be interesting, I think, is to talk about our next figure is Nguyễn Thị Bình. And, you know, just to get a peek inside what that era looks like through her lens, and what she did right, what she did wrong, and what the administration around her, you know, I'm curious to hear, because was she the first female president of the Communist Party?
I don't want to say anything wrong here. She was, okay, the country's, so she was vice president. And she was not president.
First vice president, female.
Right.
We'll get into her. I mean,
we'll get into her.
No need to get into the details. We want to tease out. That is our next figure in the Vid History Maker subseries here in the Vietnamese podcast. If you have any questions and comments, please leave them in the comment section, both on the Spotify, Apple, or YouTube platforms. Kevin and I read every comment, and we can't comment on every comment, but we do appreciate everyone leaving comments.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Wynn, Catherine Wynn, Tina Fam, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.